Well, if you will you open your Bibles to the book of Ruth? Ruth is pretty early in the Old Testament. I'll give you a few minutes to get there. Get the first few books, and then Joshua, Judges, and then Ruth. We'll be in chapter 2 this morning. Been walking through this book for a couple of weeks. This is week number 3, and as you see behind me, we're going to talk about what faith in the field looks like. You know what we could really use outside is some rain, right? Man, it's just been so long. What has it been, 3 or 4 hours or something? It's been a long time. I was looking out my window of the office this morning, or not this morning, but this week, although probably shortly I could do the same thing. And the wind was just really howling, and there's these real tall trees across the street over there, and that's kind of a telltale sign that something's coming. That's just kind of the thing that I look for. And the trees were rocking, and then sure enough, just a few moments later, boom, it just comes pouring down. If you need to know what day it was, just pick a day. It was any of the days. It happened all of the days. But you ever say that, like see the trees rocking and think to yourself or say out loud to somebody, man, look at that wind. You ever say that phrase, look at the wind? But that's like an oxymoronic statement, right? You can't look at wind. Wind is invisible. What do you mean when you say that? Well, you mean, look at what the wind is producing. Of course, that would be weird to say that, so you never say it that way. But you say, look at the wind. But the reason I say that is, wind's impact is seen even if the wind itself is unseen, because the presence of wind produces effects and outcomes. The reason I start with that is that that's what our faith is like. Faith is like that. Faith is this intangible. It's sort of like an emotion, a feeling, a decision, but it's intangible and it's invisible. But it's not an emotion that stands alone. And though it's invisible or intangible, it is accompanied, like wind, by action that makes evident its presence, even if it is unseen. The big idea this morning is this, that faith is a voluntary choice that requires daily renewal. Sometimes you'll hear someone use the phrase, today you got to choose joy, because joy, though it's an emotion or a feeling, it's often a thing that you have to choose to have, because sometimes life circumstances do not bring that to you. Faith is a lot like that. Faith is a lot like that. There may be days that it is hard to have faith, but on those days, my encouragement to you would be to choose it. Choose faith, even when it's difficult. It requires a daily renewal. Today we're going to see that the willing faith of this lady named Ruth collides with the favorable fruit of God in her life and around her life. What we'll see this morning in Ruth is the same hand of God that moved in her life is the hand of God that moves and can move in your life every day. That we're going to discover how we can open our eyes of faith and see the hand of God at work around us. But you know what requires a choice? To choose to see. To choose eyes of faith. So if you have your Bible with me, let's look at it together. Ruth chapter 2, we're going to be in verses 1 through 23. A good bit of reading, and then we'll make some observations as we go, okay? Chapter 2, starting in verse 1, says this. Now, Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you've done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. So she sat and beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw that she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. And Ruth the Moabite said, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all the harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law. If you haven't been with us the last couple of weeks, I'll just like show you a map just to show you the context of sort of the background part of this story. Do you have that map for us this morning? So the country of Moab is what you see southeast of Bethlehem and Jerusalem, which is in the northwest of that map. The way that this book has started is that there was a famine in the land of Israel, and this guy named Elimelech, who's sort of this patriarch, this father figure, leaves town with his wife Naomi and goes to the place called Moab. Moab had a dark history with God's people, and this was a godless place. They were enemies of God's people, and so they left God's place that he'd given them. Just shortly after, by the way, God had given them the promised land. They leave whenever things got difficult, when a famine struck, and they go and seek provision in a different place, even a land of Moab, such opposed land and such an opposed people to God. They sought to find favor in the land of the enemy instead of in the favor of the land that God had given them. And what we see from Naomi, sort of tracking her story the last couple of weeks, is that she says she leaves full. And what she means by that is, I left with a husband, I left with my sons, but she comes back empty. Her husband has died, her sons have died, and so she is grieving and comes back with her new daughter-in-law, which would be Ruth, a Moabite woman that she picked up in this land called Moab. She comes back and she feels absolutely devastated and grieved because to her, she has come back with nothing. Even though she's come back with Ruth, she still says, I've come back empty because of the death of Elimelech and her sons. Naomi went from full to empty. But what we see is that Israel went from empty to full. She came bitterly back to Israel, but God had poured out on Israel now from famine to fullness. And we see this hope in verses 22 of last chapter we looked at, and then also in verse 1 as it talks about harvest time. Food is here. Look at verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, her husband's clan, whose name was Boaz. The author tells the reader what Ruth doesn't yet know. And this is sort of like it's almost like if you were watching a movie and the narrator says something like, this is the story of what's about to happen, this man named Boaz. But Ruth doesn't yet know that. And Naomi really doesn't know of Boaz's eventual involvement in the story, but it foreshadows provision and restoration. Now, we read a lot about like gleaning, if that's not a term that you're familiar with. Gleaning basically means collecting bit by bit. It's picking up leftovers and scraps and little pieces along the way to hopefully compile and build a sum that would be sufficient to feed and eat on. It says a lot about gleaning, and there's a little bit of context I have to share with you before we can really understand our passage, and there's just some context that's really important. So Ruth would be going out into this place, and the law, the Mosaic law, those first five books of your Old Testament, one of the things that it describes is what I'm going to describe as a work for welfare program. It's like a work for welfare program. I'm choosing those words very carefully because it's not just a handout. It requires work, but it is a situation and a provision that's built into their law to say there are people in our community, the widows, like Naomi and Ruth, the poor, the marginalized of society. And basically what this thing is, here's some charity for you, but you have to put in the work to get it. We belonged to a church a few years ago, Brooke and I did. This is before we had kids. But at Christmas time every year, they would have this, it's sort of like a work for welfare program. They would buy, and the families in the church would buy lots of toys for little kids. And it was for families that couldn't afford to give their kids a big Christmas with lots of toys and things like that. And so the families would purchase gifts that may cost $50, $60, $70, $100, $150, nice, expensive things. But then the church would discount them, not give them away for free, not full welfare, but they would discount them down to $5, $10, $15. Now, why? Because it meant something to work for still being able to give your kids a Christmas. Work for welfare. And this is biblical. It's God's design here, is that there is a welfare program in place for the impoverished, the least of these, but it's important to still work for the charity that they're to receive. And so what do we see here? That they're to go out and collect, to glean, even if there are things that are left on the edges of the field. So what the welfare program would be, the work for welfare is, the harvesters would go out, the reapers would go out, and they would collect and collect and collect and collect. This would be barley and wheat, but there would be some that was left over. And instead of picking every single thing clean, there would be some that was left over on the edges for people that were impoverished to be able to come and pick up and find a livable amount of food to eat. And so Ruth is coming as a gleaner, coming to pick up what was left over, built into this law. Naomi sends her out for this purpose, to eke out a living amount of food. They belong to this class of gleaners. And why did Naomi send Ruth out? I think that this is either one of two things. Either she had aged beyond the gleaning ability, it was work, or perhaps she was in depression or despair over her circumstances. It does say that she was very bitter about this, and maybe she just sends out Ruth out of convenience. I'm not really sure. But it's a harsh context, because while Naomi would be able to glean as a Jewish person, as an Israelite, Ruth is there as a foreigner. And so would she be treated well? Would she be seen as a gleaner? You see, what we see here, and that important context is important, because what we see is that Ruth is stepping out in faith that there was a generous, God-fearing landowner who would make room for not just the poor, but to the poor foreigner, which is what she was. If you're taking notes this morning, there are a couple of principles, three principles that I think we can learn from this text and learn from Ruth. Number one is that faith in the field is active, not passive. Faith is active. Faith is not passive. It's a work for welfare, right? It's active, not passive. Though Ruth was clearly a woman who had come to trust Israel's God. We looked at that last week. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. I'll be buried where you're buried, is what she told Naomi, because she was trusting in her God, Yahweh. Ruth still doesn't just sit on her hands waiting for God to drop food in their laps. Faith does not mean sitting there and doing nothing. It means trusting God and going and working to see what happens. Her faith mobilizes her, in other words, active faith. It mobilizes her to work. Verses 2 and 3 say this: "And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor.'" Again, she doesn't yet know about Boaz. "And she said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers," again, the leftovers, "and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz." Now again, Ruth is not from around here. She's a Moabite. She's among them, but she's not one of them. And she leaves her home out of the city of Bethlehem to the field, sort of like going out into the country, hoping that she would find a favorable landowner that would allow her to pick up some food. And unbeknownst to her, she came to the one field in particular that belonged to her deceased father-in-law's family. What are the happens? What are the chances? It even says that, right? Where is it at? Verse 3, it says, "She set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers." And it says, I love this from the author, "And she happened to come to the part of the field that belongs to Boaz." It's sort of a little bit of an elbow bump. Like, it just so happened, by circumstance, by chance, that she happened to run into the place where she would find a relative, unbeknownst to her. And this is a bit of an elbow bump, as I said, from the author. It's like a wink. Like, there's something that's happening, a little bit more than what Ruth realizes. It makes me think of on Christmas Day, and I've referenced Christmas a couple of times now, but on Christmas, I remember when I was in like sixth grade, we really wanted, I'm going to date myself a little bit here, Sega Dreamcast. Does anybody know what that is? Sega Dreamcast. All right, a few of you. And it's like a video game console, and we really wanted the Sega Dreamcast, and like we'd asked, me and my two brothers and my sister had asked for that from my parents for Christmas, and we'd opened up all the gifts under the tree, and there was no Sega, and we were like, we were really grateful kids, and so we didn't even complain, right? We were really grateful kids, so we didn't do any of that. But we, you know, it was a little bit like, okay, we got all these things. Like, well, you know, this is awesome, but also like, man, Sega's not here. Sega Dreamcast is not here. And then this is my dad or my mom. It sounds like something my dad would do, but it could have been my mom, but I think it was my dad. He goes, well, what's that? What's that way back up under there? Why don't you look at that one way back there? Is there something like that? And it's, oh, you know what he's doing. There's this box. It's not even wrapped. It's like a cardboard box, you know? And we open it, and sure enough, you know, it was a party. Christmas was saved, right? It reminds me of this meme. Can you put that meme up there? Do you guys ever seen this meme before? When I thought about that, I was like, yeah, that was my, was that ever you guys, anybody, was that your parents? I don't know. None of you, just me. I'm weird. All right, you can take that down. Thanks for humiliating me. I see this in our passage because there's a bit of an elbow bump from the author of Ruth of saying, man, it just so happened that she got to the field. I mean, this is God's hand, y'all. God's hand is all over this. He's the father who says, well, why don't you go to that field? Of all the fields belonging to all the families of this city of Bethlehem, she comes to the one belonging to the wealthy, God-fearing member of her own family. And even more coincidental, I'm putting that in quotes, Boaz decides on this of all days to make the trip from the city of Bethlehem to go check on his field. Just so happened, right? Look at verse 4. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. Notice he's using the proper name of God, Yahweh. Yahweh be with you. And they answered, Yahweh bless you. You see, this is a man of faith. He's already identified as a worthy man in verse 1. Now he's portrayed as honored as a God-fearing man by those who work with him. This is a good dude. Look at verses 5 through 7. Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came. And she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. Notice that Boaz says, whose woman is this? Whose is this? He doesn't say, who is this, but whose is this? Boaz's question is, where does she fit into this society? Whose is she? What is her place here? The paraphrase of the guy that's in charge, the servant, says, she's an outsider. She doesn't really belong to anyone or belong anywhere. She has a reputation of care for Naomi, renouncing her culture, religion. She's come with her and she's supported her. But he says, and this is my paraphrase, but she's worked her tail off all day. Yeah? She's been working hard, except for a short break. What a neat detail. We saw last week, and this is huge, that Ruth, in following Naomi to Bethlehem, she chose hardship over comfort because she trusted that Yahweh, that God, would provide for her. She chose the hard thing because she knew it was the obedient thing. But notice, once again, active, not passive. That doesn't mean that she gets to Bethlehem and just sits back and waits for whatever that blessing is to happen. She works. She goes out and she makes it happen, sort of. Her faith isn't passive, it's active. It reminds me of Philippians 2, 12 and 13, which you may know this passage, that God tells us through the hand of Paul to work out your own faith with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Now watch, look at that verse for me real quick. Who's doing the working? Yes, right? Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works. Who's working? The answer is yes. You're to work while God is working. And this is exactly what Naomi's doing. She trusts that God is at work. And she goes to work. You see, faith doesn't simply mean sitting around and waiting for blessings and provisions to fall in your lap. It reminds me of the movie Field of Dreams. You ever seen that movie Field of Dreams? That's a really, really great movie. And like the ending is just a tearjerker, man. It's amazing, especially as a father and now understanding family to a whole different degree. What an amazing ending to that movie. If you haven't seen it, I really encourage you to do so. But the line that is repeated from that movie is, if you build it, he will come. It's not they will come, it's he will come. And I'm not going to spoil the ending, but I guess I will. It's his dad. Anyway, so, but in that movie, it's so neat that Kevin Costner's character is told, if you will build, and your cornfield, you build a baseball field, right? You build this baseball field, and if you do it, he will come. And by the way, this mysterious voice that is whispering this to him out in his pasture, he doesn't understand where it's coming from, what it is, who it is, but it's just this voice that says, you got to do this. And if you do this, there will be an amazing blessing as a result. And so, you know what he does? He builds it on faith. It's active faith. There's a blessing that awaits you, but you have to put in the work by faith, trusting what's going to happen. And so if you've seen the ending, you know what happens perhaps. But that's exactly what occurs. Faith doesn't simply mean sitting around waiting for blessings and provisions to fall in your lap. It means doing, working out your salvation with fear and trembling. What does that look like for you and me? Well, perhaps you're a student. I just love that we have young people in here. They're students, whether it be in elementary school or middle school and high school. And look, you want good grades and you want to succeed and do well in class and in school. And you say, God, I just pray that I would ace this test. And what do? You just never study because he's good, right? No, you work out that prayer. So yes, you trust God, but you know what God honors? The work. God honors the work. He also honors parents, grandparents, adults in this room. It's not maybe not be grades in school for you. Maybe it is work. You may be looking for a job or have found yourself in a tough situation where you're trying to find fulfillment in the job place. You say, well, God is good, and so he's just going to take care of it. Well, hold on a second. Are you putting in the work? Are you praying for God to work through it? Are you putting yourself out there, perhaps, and looking for the job that God is calling you to? Are you saying no to the comfortable things if it means going to the uncomfortable but the right thing? Is God going to drop it in your lap? Maybe. But I know he honors the work. The same thing could be said about a relationship. Maybe you're seeking a relationship with somebody to fulfill or fulfill your loneliness, and you just think, well, God is good, and so he'll deliver when he's ready to. Well, that's true, but are you praying for that person that God may have for you? Are you taking care of yourself and working out your relationship with the Lord while he works at the same time? You may be in a toxic relationship or a toxic friendship. A friend told me this week, I think a really memorable quote, sometimes in order to elevate, you have to separate. That's putting in the work. That's being obedient, even when it's difficult. And trusting that God also is at work. It could be friendships, seeking the right friends, praying for them. That's the work. It could be that you're desiring so strongly for your child to love the Lord, his or her God, with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength. But you don't just release them and say, hopefully they'll figure it out. What do? You do the work. You pray for them. You parent them. You disciple them. You point them to Jesus in every season. You know why? Because faith is active, not passive. We are called to do what we can, and as we do, we trust that God will provide for our needs. In other words, I'll put it this way. The very popular phrase that sounds really catchy and really good, let go and let God, is a thoroughly unbiblical phrase. God never calls you to let go. Never calls you to let go. He calls you to work out your faith with fear and trembling. He wants you in the fight. He just wants you to trust him with the fight. Because God honors active faith. He honors active faith. Ruth sets an admirable example of active faith. She trusts God while doing what she could do to be obedient. She does the work while God is working. Faith is active, not passive. Faith in the field also, number two, it means looking for God's hand through ordinary means. And I put ordinary in quotes because sometimes we can call something ordinary when really it's extraordinary. That God is at work through ordinary things. And faith means looking for God's hand even through the things that may seem on the surface ordinary. We see next the first interaction between this wealthy Bethlehemite and the poor foreigner from Moab in verses 8 and 9. Look at verses 8 and 9 with me. Then Boaz said to Ruth, their first interaction here, now listen, my daughter, Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. What he's saying here is you stay here, you go nowhere else, because right here you'll be fed and protected. Look at verse 10. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take a notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" This is a vital verse that says much of what we've been seeing behind the text the last couple of weeks. That culturally, in Ruth's view, and surely in her experience, she has not been met with blessings and honor by God's people. Remember when Naomi and her arrived? You know who they focused on? Naomi. Naomi's back. No mention of Ruth, who is with her companion. By the way, her name means companion. We looked at that last week. When she arrived, there's no mention of courtesy and hospitality toward her. Instead, it seems here that this is probably, possibly, the first time that someone really pays her mind and gives her some sort of a generous and amazing nod. And she is surprised by it. She's confused by this. Look at verses 11 through 13. But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. And now you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before." And here's the blessing. Check this out. What an amazing statement from a foreigner or to a foreigner. She feels so undeserving of this. And it says this. Boaz says, "The Lord, Yahweh, repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." Boaz has looked beyond Ruth's status as a foreigner into her heart as a woman of faith in his God, Yahweh. He pronounces not just his own well wishes to her, but based on her reaction, I believe, and this is just me, but I believe what was possibly the very first appeal for divine blessing in her direction that she had received from her new people. They weren't really treating her like they were her people. But Boaz is doing just that. The interesting thing to me is that Boaz, and here's the ordinary means here, okay? The interesting thing is that Boaz essentially will himself become the answer to his own prayer for Ruth. He says, "May God bless you. May he pour out on you everything that you're, everything, I guess, commiserate to the fact that you have been so kind to Naomi. May he be kind to you." But the amazing thing is that he is God's kindness to her. He's sort of going to fulfill his own prayer for her. Through Boaz, God's hand is at work to provide and restore for her. What he's saying is, because of your faith, may God feed you, may he provide for you, and may he protect you. And so my question for you is this, just like a few minutes ago. Who provided for Ruth? Boaz or God? Yes. Who protected Ruth? Boaz or God? Yes. They both did. And I think the same is true for you and me. There are ordinary means of grace around you. People that care for you, provide for you. A job that is there for you. A car that God has provided for you. You may think, "Well, I applied for that job. Well, I got that job." Did you? Yeah. But who gave you the job? God did. "Well, I saved up my money and I made that purchase." Did you? Who gave you the money? Who gave you the job? Same can be said about family. "Well, we had the kids. We procreated." Well, did you? Or did God give you those kids? Your health. "Well, I'm the one that takes vitamins. I'm the one that exercises. I'm the one doing the work." Well, sure you are. But where does your health come from? James 1:17. Every good and perfect gift is from above. Where does it come from? Your hard work? Yes. Who else? God. Every good and perfect gift is from above. And faith, I just need to slow down and say this. Faith means realizing that you're not self-made. Faith means realizing that you are not self-made. You're not self-made. On the other side of that, look, I think that there's partially we look at Ruth and say, okay, so she was working hard and yet God was working. She did the work and yet God provided. That's an ordinary means of grace. She saw Boaz as an amazing answer to her long-sought prayer. Okay, so he was the means of grace, and so there's an ordinary means there. But here's what I want you to see. We also sort of flip around that, and I think that we should emulate Boaz through being the means of God's grace to someone else every single day. If God places on your heart the prompting to be a blessing to someone else, God is prompting you to be his hand to that person in their life. If you feel prompted to say a kind word to someone, don't think, that's weird, I don't want to say that. No, say that because God is prompting you to be the means of his grace in that person's life. Thank people sincerely and specifically. If you go out to eat, tip them well. You know what you have an opportunity to be? Ordinary means of God's grace in that person's life. Text someone the kindnesses that come to your mind. Tell your kids that you're thankful for and proud of them. Tell your parents you're thankful for and proud of them. And when they ask you why, tell them this. God prompted me to do that. It's his grace to you. He's done that. And this is what Boaz is doing. May God do for you, and I'm going to do for you. Faith is not only looking for God's kindness, but also looking to be God's kindness to someone else. Faith is not only looking for God's kindness, but also looking to be God's kindness to someone else. Boaz was a means of God's kindness to Ruth. Ruth's response is, I don't work here, I don't live here, I don't belong here, and yet you treat me as one of your own who does live here and does belong here. And that leads us into the last thing this morning, that faith in the field is, number three, anchored in the gospel. Faith in the field is anchored in the gospel. I love where we're going with this. If you didn't catch what I said a moment ago, Ruth says, essentially, I don't work here, I don't live here, I don't belong here, and yet you treat me as one of your own. Is that anybody else's story? Whew, we see this in Jesus. See, the favor of Boaz just continues to literally pile up. He's clearly the vessel through which God is pouring out his grace on not just Ruth, but also on Naomi. We see this as this lunch break occurs. Look at verses 14 through 16. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied. I'm going to say that again. She ate until she was satisfied. There's a reason that the author of Ruth tells us that. And she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men. He goes one step further. He says, let her glean even among the sheaves, like the things that were loaded, right? The places where she could find a lot, not just scraps, but a lot. And do not reproach her. Don't correct her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean and do not rebuke her. She eats to fullness. By the way, eating to fullness is so much a norm in your life that you don't even realize what an amazing, outrageous blessing it is that anyone would ever get to do that. In other parts of the world, rarely can someone eat to fullness, and you do it almost every single meal, I bet. Just because something is normal for you doesn't make it normal. The reason the author of Ruth says she ate to be satisfied to fullness is because it was absolutely amazing that she would have that opportunity, especially as a foreigner and even a poor person with nothing to her name. Ruth knew this privilege, so it's time to go to work again. But then Boaz commanded his men to be deliberately careless in their harvesting. It's like a, oops. It's like when you spread out the Easter eggs for the little kids. Oops. There's one just laying in the grass. That's what I thought about. Oops. This is what he's telling them to do. Look at verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned. And it was about an ephah of barley. This is about 6 gallons. It would weigh roughly 40 to 50 pounds, several weeks worth of food. What I thought about is, like, maybe you have a big dog, like a huge bag of dog food. You ever have one of these? You guys have to shop for those. They're like this tall, and you have to carry them like a, you know, professional weightlifter or something and have to hoist it over your shoulder. This is exactly what we see in our passage. This is an ephah. It's 40 to 50 pounds worth of barley. Look at verse 18. And she took it up and went into the city. So back home, her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. So after lunch, she brought her leftovers. You can understand Naomi's surprise. She sends out a Moabite, a foreigner, expecting to get scraps. And she brings all this on. 19. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. Check this out. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." If you've been here the last couple of weeks, or maybe listened to the podcast if you haven't been here and caught up on sermons, you know how amazing this moment is for Naomi, because she has gone from pleasant, which is what Naomi means, to bitter, which is what she said. "Call me Mara," it means bitter. She's gone from pleasant to bitter. She went from full to empty, and now she's saying, "The Lord has poured out his kindness on us." She's not only remembered the living, you and me, but he's even honored and remembered the dead, Elimelech and her sons. All right, look, we're going to get more into some of the historicity here, but I'm going to wind it down in a second. In Boaz, God not only met their immediate needs, but he was also preparing them to be redeemed by a redeemer, and we'll talk about that some next time, but a redeemer who would reinstate ownership of land, and more importantly, the possibility of children to continue Elimelech's lineage. In other words, here's what I mean by that. Naomi sees now the hope of seeing her empty circumstances that she blamed on God now being filled by that same sovereign God. She is seeing that the same God that she blamed for her circumstances is reminding her that he is God and that he cares for his own. All because a redeemer named Boaz invited a poor foreign outsider to sit at his table. And in that, Boaz is a Christ figure for us. Friends, God doesn't just allow you, a distant sinner, reluctant admission to glean in his field. He invites you to be seated at his table. And he doesn't just extend to you a visitor's stay. He extends to you the offer of adoption into his family. How? Why? Because he sent a redeemer who stepped from light into darkness and sought out the foreigner, who pursued us in our hopeless emptiness, because we truly are empty apart from God. We truly are empty apart from his salvation. And he purchased us with his blood, thus making us full. And while crumbs from below his table would be more than we deserve, rather, in Christ, we are sons and daughters, co-heirs of the kingdom of God, because God is our redeemer. For two types of people, and maybe you're one of the two, Naomi or Ruth. For Naomi types, he is the one, he is the redeemer for the one who belongs, but has been running and now feels foreign. That's Naomi. She belonged to the family of God, and yet she ran and found home and provision in a land apart from God. And now she finds herself groveling. God, do you still accept me back into this place? And maybe that's you, the one who belongs, and yet you've been running and feeling foreign. But he's also the redeemer for the distant foreigner who seeks belonging, and that's Ruth. And so my question for you this morning is this: which are you? Are you a child of God who, like Naomi, has begun feeling empty, who feels bitter, who feels in despair, who is caught in a pattern of sin that has made you feel at times so foreign to God? I have a reminder for you, if that's you. You have a redeemer, and his name is Jesus. Titus 3:5 says that he saved us not because of works done by us in righteousness, but according to his own mercy by the washing of regeneration and renewal of the Holy Spirit. What I mean by that is, if good works didn't save you, then bad works can't make you unsavable or unsave you. Even if you feel foreign, you have a home, you have a redeemer who loves you. It's his mercy, his work, his gift. And what do you need to do with it? What do you need to do about it? Come back. Come back. Be restored. You don't have to earn that. It was earned for you on the blood of the cross. Nothing else will make you full. Or maybe you're more like Ruth, foreign from the family of God, but lately, and maybe this morning, feeling the draw to surrender and make his family your own family. And I want to tell you this, that he has a seat at his table for you, not as a sinner, but as a child of God. It's easy to miss, but Ruth did not have to clean up her life to be seen by Boaz. She did not have to clean up her life to be favored by the Redeemer. She didn't have to make herself look like royalty to be seen by God's sent Redeemer, and neither do you. Come as you are and see who Jesus proves himself to be. You may claim to have the wind of faith in you, but it's time to see the trees shake in your life, proving the movement that you claim is within, because your faith in the field is active, not passive.